afternoon session, and on the agenda is determine quantity of benefits for identifying coverage units. And before we start, thank you all for contributing with examples and comments, which were, I think, very helpful. And I will give the word to Anne, our specialist for coverage units.
Thank you. So Agenda Paper 5 continues our discussion from last meeting on coverage units. And first, I'd like to reiterate Martin's thanks for all your comments and examples. They've been so helpful, and I appreciate the amount of work and time they must have taken, and I am very grateful for all your help, so thank you. Based on your responses, Agenda Paper 5, it identifies some points that are relevant to insurance contracts, both with and without investment components. It gives an analysis of the accounting requirements for insurance contracts without investment components and an analysis of the accounting requirements for insurance contracts with investment components. And then it illustrates the analysis with some examples in the appendices. We think that IFRS 17 establishes some principles for determining coverage units. It doesn't provide detailed guidance on how to apply those principles, and we don't think that creating voluminous amounts of guidance would be desirable or possible given the variety of products around the world. Rather, what we want to do is to allow practice to develop the best ways of applying the principles that we identify. And we hope our discussion today will contribute to that development, and we expect that there will be further development as people think about these principles and how best to apply them. Just before we start a discussion, just to say, to have the most useful discussion, we need to be disciplined in how we use the examples. I mean, we are interested in your views on the analysis of the examples in the appendices, but I want to focus on what your views about the examples mean for the principles that we've tried to set out in the main body of the paper. The objective, I think, is to try and develop a robust analysis of the principles, not a detailed analysis of particular examples. We also need to avoid introducing new fact patterns, because if we do, I will get very confused, and I expect other people might get confused too. So I'd like to start by getting your, observations on the points that apply to both insurance contracts with and without investment components, then move on to the principles for insurance contracts without investment components, and then look at the analysis for investment components. So if we could try and keep it structured in that way, I think that might help as well. So first, the points that I had identified in the paper that are relevant to insurance contracts, both with and without investment components, are set out in paragraph 16 to 20 of the paper. And they sort of help set the scene and the context of what IFRS 17 is doing in this area. So to start with, I'd be interested in any observations you had on those paragraphs.
Sorry, which paragraph?
16 to 20. So this is where I'm trying to draw out some things about IFRS 17 that are relevant in thinking about the release of the CSM.
I thought paragraph 17, albeit true, seemed irrelevant to the situation. It's, it is clear that we sometimes recognize an obligation before the coverage period begins, but I don't think that really had anything. That didn't seem to me to be related to the issue.
There, I was just trying to distinguish between bearing risk, an entity bearing insurance risk, and the coverage period, because we don't think they're the same, and I thought it was worth making that point sort of up front.
Okay, well, that maybe has some downstream issues for the definition of the coverage unit that make me uncomfortable.
Thorsten?
Yeah. Thank you, Martin. In paragraph 20, I read the staff thinks the determination of coverage units to achieve this objective is not an accounting policy choice, but involves judgment and estimates. And I'm not sure if this is really a helpful statement, let me say. It sounds like a lot of wiggle room and the opportunity to negotiate about this topic. I think maybe we can clarify it a bit.
The point I was trying to make was that it's not a choice. Like your objective is to identify how service is being provided, and that's the objective you're aiming for, and you have to do your, you know, the best way of estimating how service is provided. You can't choose to do it this way or this way if one way is clearly the way that service is provided. That was what I was trying to draw out there.
Roman?
Yeah, only a small observation on paragraph 9. That is, of course, also reflected then in the summary of the last TRG meeting. You are stating that TRG members, and it's repeated then in 21, that TRG members concurred with your principle you derive from the standard that coverage units should not reflect the likelihood of insured events occurring to the extent that affect the amount expected to be claimed in a period. And I have made the point in the February meeting that I do not necessarily see that this is a principle which you need to derive from the standard. I would have difficulties to support that statement. The question is really if we are all agreeing that reads like that, that this is the starting point for the analysis. I believe if this is the starting point for the analysis, then many things which you've been later on of referencing to makes sense. But if you're questioning already that, which I do, then you can also question some other conclusions you draw later. So only wanted to make already the point that I have some difficulties. I understand it, and it's one possible interpretation, but I would not see it as a kind of static principle which you all considerations which we will have then later on need to reference back always. Okay, does it meet that requirement, yes or no? I would not read it in that narrow way.
Sitcher?
I just want to make a quick comment regarding the issue on accounting policy choice versus judgment and estimate mentioned by Constant earlier. Perhaps the next sentence in paragraph 20 would help you. You say the judgment and estimate should be determined systematically and rationally.
Okay. Francesco.
I have only one comment. That's on paragraph 17. I thought that the preamble of the paragraph before you quote the paragraph in the basis for conclusions was leading us to an explanation as to when the two periods are different, but the quote doesn't immediately help me as a reader to get what is it you're thinking about when the two periods are different. I thought you would call the fact that claims handling periods are obviously beyond the coverage and there is insurance risk, but that's not really what the BC paragraphs are about. It's more about the initial commission period. So you were looking at the beginning, I was looking at the end. Is it any reason why you didn't look at the end as well? Or?
I thought these paragraphs were the ones that most closely, that most clearly explained that the board didn't think that coverage was the same as risk. But you're right, I could have used the fact that the liability for incurred claims.
That difference is normally a matter of weeks, but the other one is a matter of years. Yeah. So that's why it's far more material in the other end of the coverage period.
Yeah, that's good.
Fine. That's good. It was just a purely.
Don't read anything into my choice of that rather than.
That's great. So if it is also that is an example, then I'll be very happy. The other four paragraphs are clear for me. Thank you.
Okay.
In that case, could we move on to look at the analysis for insurance contracts without investment components? So these are the sorts of contracts that we discussed at the last meeting. And I'd be particularly interested in your views on the principles that I've drawn out in paragraph 30. And in terms of discussing these, if you have comments on the examples that relate to this, I'd be very interested in hearing those as well. But if it's possible to tie your comments on the examples back into whether they support or don't support these principles, then that would be very helpful.
Leslie? Just a couple of preamble comments. I agree with Roman, and it's in paragraph 21B, it's even more. It says TRG members concurred, not just observed. 22B, and this gets to one of the principles as well. I believe it's 30B. Both specify or use the adjective insurance before service. It says the objective is to reflect the insurance service provided. That's not my understanding of B119A unless you have no investment component, okay? I understand that this is no investment component, and so it's okay, but I want to discuss that point later. I don't want to have that established that it is limited to insurance services at this point. Sorry, there was one other thing. I think the bits about the amount of coverage provided, you want to reflect that different contracts have different amounts of coverage. I think that is valid if it's the same type of insurance service, but when you have different types of coverage entirely, I don't think it's correct to add up. Later, but it definitely comes back to this principle. The I forget which example it is actually.
There is an example. Where? Yeah, example 11, which is in this section of the paper actually. So
it is okay. So I had an issue with 42C with B42C being valid. Because if it's just the sum of the levels of cover provided, to me, you're adding apples and oranges in that respect. I would have expected something that said you need some kind of simple proxy for the amount of CSM that's associated or that each coverage contributes. In other words, it should be linked to certain. Some coverages have a lot of CSM. Some coverages have a little CSM. You would be trying to find a simple proxy. The other thing I would like to say is I love paragraph 29. It is not possible to set detailed requirements that will apply. There are so many examples here, and just looking at through the examples, it feels almost like as soon as you start touching one.
Yeah.
I feel like I want to step back and say, oh, just pick something reasonable. We need some kind of simple proxy for running off the CSM that's based on the services provided, fine. But there are just so many different types of products and variety. I have difficulty. And as soon as I see some of these examples, I know you say you don't want to go to a different fact pattern, but the trouble is, the examples have implications for a slightly different fact pattern that seem egregious, that seem like something that does not make sense. So I'm sympathetic to this complexity, but this really makes me uncomfortable.
Darren? I just wanted to ask you while you were on that example. So I think what the staff said in the discussion around that was that C is one way that you could definitely do it, and there will be circumstances in which you can add your apples and oranges together because they are apples. But then they go on to talk about the option D, which seems to be coming very close to your, because that discusses some
D's
of the acceptable
little,
proxies.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. It's the blanket that B42C is valid. I mean, it may or may not be, depending on the situation. Like, it's not going to be valid at all if I've got all of my coverage had none of the CSM. I mean, if all of the CSM is generated by the one coverage, I would just want to pick the quantity of that coverage.
But that's what you're able to do with D, and it comes back to, I think, your comment about the rational basis.
If to the extent that in the earlier parts you open it up and say that it's a matter of judgment and that different approaches may or may not be valid, I'm good with that. I really appreciate the effort to recognize that it's very complicated and that we are going to apply some sort of reason. So if that's the context of this, okay.
Yes, it is. It is.
Good.
Yeah.
JP?
It does, Mike. Okay, let's imagine that there is one contract that has no investment component. Originally, and I suggest the examples in which there was a contract that has a savings component in it. But this time, you just excluded the savings component. So let's assume that there are only coverages, insurance coverages. For a contract that has multiple riders, which is a typical type of a product that are being sold in Korea as of today, you know, the reason why we suggested using premium as a proxy to recognize quantitative benefit for coverage unit is that, you know, we actually couldn't find a way to, you know, to find out a reasonable proxy, you know, to represent the different levels of a cover all across the period. That's the difficulty that we had to face. But we thought that in this, you know, paragraph, you just mentioned the method based on premiums, but the premiums, not exactly the premiums that amount that received from policyholders. What I meant was saying premium was, you know, it's kind of probably weighted average benefits, considering those kind of probability of claims. But I was a little bit disappointed with your argument that you rejected using the probability of claims in identifying the, you know, the quantity of benefits. I was upset, and I couldn't logically, from my heart, cannot understand why you rejected the probability of claims. That's why I just want to ask to you, and I just want to hear from other TH members of your group.
I agree that whether we include the probability of claims is a really big question. And I started off by being pretty sure that we should have a strong view that you shouldn't, because the service is standing ready. Let's just focus on contracts that don't have investment components for the moment. That, you know, the service is standing ready, not the sort of likelihood of claims in each period. I do wonder whether, so in terms of allocating the CSM for a group of contracts with the same sort of cover, I don't think there's a role for probability in terms of the timing of the release of the CSM. I do wonder if, when you're looking at different types of products, different types of cover, to assess the sort of weighting in the group of, you know, how much service is relating to this type of cover rather than how much service is relating to that type of cover, it may have a role, because otherwise you could have a sort of add-on. A type of insurance that really does feel just like a sort of add-on to the main product, but that it has a very high maximum amount that you could claim, but it's there, like it's not expected to be used really, and to not take that into account somehow in reflecting the service, I do accept that seems odd. So I going back to your comment about, you know, let's not be absolutely definitive about whether we reflect the likelihood of claims. I think we need to focus on, you know, the objective of what service is being provided. And I certainly think the stand ready service for a type of cover means that you are standing ready, and the fact that, you know, it's more likely that you'll get a claim here or there, that, you know, you're standing ready and that's it. But if you're trying to compare different types of cover, I think in the way that you determine how much service is provided, it might have a role. It could have a role.
For a contract that has only one coverage, it's just the way as, you know, quantitative benefit using maximum cover. But there are products with so many, you know, components. It's almost impossible for us to find indicator to take.
Ken?
Hi, thank you. I just echo that point about 29. I thought that was a really good summary, high level, and it sort of encapsulates the problem of this. And I have to confess, from a general insurance point of view, this is almost the coverage units are the topic you didn't want or need to have, because I think we could have figured this out anyway. I think there was quite a good understanding of what was required. But based on the paper last time and the examples that were there, we've responded to that, as you requested. I think that the principles are pretty okay. They seem to work in practice. I would highlight that the danger of examples, I think, is highlighted by one of the examples you put in here, which is one that's come from the Australian market, albeit it's not a product from the Australian market. It's example 10, and it's the one on transaction liability. And I think there's probably a bit of a misunderstanding of what the type of product is. This is a product which is covering a claim event, and the event is the execution of a particular document with a particular content on a particular day. You could liken it to something like a concert or a short period event that is being covered. But the contract itself is limited in time and in terms of the sum assured, as you would expect, so that the emergence of information around the claims that would happen later in the process are capped at a certain time and a certain dollars. So that is actually covering the one-day event. The way that it's been interpreted in here is not the way that we look at these products. This is interpreted as a different type of product. It's interpreted more as a claims-made product, where it's actually covering the identification of the problem at later time. So perhaps we don't want to dwell too much on specifics, but here this is clearly a real product that is in market now, and what you've come up with is a completely different answer to what preparers and auditors have determined is the case now. So it's an interesting example of why it is dangerous, I think, to go with examples, but I appreciate it does help people if there are some in the paper.
Okay, Zelly?
Yes, I quite agree with Roman Leslie just said that consider about the likelihood, but I appreciate what Anne just commented. But for me, it's not seem to be a role that you can consider possibility in if we add a different risk together. I think it just seemed to be wrong to add a different risk together if you consider for the CSM amortization. I think if it's the same risk, it's right. You cannot consider the possibility over the time. But if it's totally different risk, I think the likelihood or possibility should be considered to come up with a weighted risk or something. So also agree quite very like paragraph 29. So for looking at those examples and possibly there's some examples you do not take in, the real world is so different. And if we can just stick to the principle, I think we can find a way to suit our case, because each case might look to be right in a particular situation, but when we look back to our similar situations, they might not be right. And if you put more fact pattern in, there will be come up with a very unreasonable result. I think that would be very dangerous to do so. And another point is that although it's in your insurance contract without investment for those examples, but I think for some, you only look at the insurance services for those general model. But to me, I think there's also an invest model. So if you look at sample 13, your conclusion, if you look at the insurance service only, it's right. But I think in such kind of contracts, there's still some kind of investment component or investment service should be considered. So I think we need to clarify whether there's totally no investment services when you use general model. And when you use the VFA, I think those two is not that clear line cut. So if we can agree that we can consider investment components in general model, so some cases will make more sense, otherwise will not.
I'd like to leave the discussion about insurance contracts with investment components.
But for example, 13, your conclusion already is there's no investment components in such kind of deferred annuity. So that's why I raise it now.
I mean, I think identifying whether there's an investment component or not, ought to be, I hesitate to say this, ought to be relatively straightforward, whether there actually is an investment component as defined under IFRS 17. I completely accept you could get contracts under the general model that have investment components, and we will talk about them later. But if there isn't an investment component, then I don't think there is any way of, or I don't think there is anything else to consider.
Investment component defined under 17,
defined,
then it is not.
Defined as IFRS 17 defines investment component.
William?
Well, I guess I want to pick up on that point a little bit, and I'm not trying to debate the definition of what's in, you know, what's in the VFA versus what's not. But there are a number of contracts that do not fit the VFA definition criteria, whose benefits directly depend on the performance of the underlying assets. The insurance benefits that are payable to the policy. I can think of various forms of universal life insurance, current assumption whole life in the United States, North American market. And so I was, you know, following, I generally understand the concept that you're trying to get to, the principle you're trying to get to in terms of amortizing the CSM in relation to the storm ready obligation. But then when I read 30G1, where it says the following method would not meet an objective here for an insurance contract without an investment component, methods in which the quantity of benefits is affected by the performance of any of the entity's assets. So, you know, let's ignore, you know, the, what's an investment component, what's not, but even for these contracts in the general model, I don't know what to determine the benefit based on this type of structure.
Could I ask a question? I mean, I was my thinking was that if you don't have an investment component, the policyholder isn't getting anything unless it's as a result of an insured event having happened. And if that's the case, then we're looking at the insurance service. We need to have a debate about what to do with insurance contracts that have investment components, but those that don't, I wasn't expecting there to be concern.
And can we distinguish between, okay, what we think in the standard is investment service, which is an variable fee approach, and what we have in the paper? Do you think that is clear? And the second question is then, okay, do you think, okay, that maybe contracts which are not under the variable fee approach, okay, that maybe under your thinking, okay, has an investment component and you are not fine, what the standard is telling you. Is that the difference? Or because otherwise I think I'm confused.
There's a mix of things. So we have insurance contracts with no investment component.
I know.
So that means that the policyholder only gets a benefit if the insured event occurs. We then have insurance contracts with investment components, but that are not in the scope of the variable fee approach, where the policyholder would get something back even if the insured event doesn't occur, but that contract, that amount that they get back, we don't think is sufficiently closely linked to specific asset returns or specific group of assets, so that they don't pull it under the VFA for some reason.
But they might return depend on asset return.
Yes. And then we have insurance contracts that have investment components and that do fall within the scope of the variable fee approach. So we've got these three bundles of contracts. And in this...
But
the
my
second
concern
one
is,
we are talking about.
So we are still talking about
the first one. We haven't got on to the investment.
That's all right. That's the class I'm talking about.
The first one. You're talking about the first one or the second one?
The one that only has insurance service.
So if it has only insurance service, it has only insurance service.
The amount of benefits paid to the policyholder.
Yes.
Vary based on the investment return of the underlying.
Yes, so that's the second.
In the event of a claim.
Oh, okay.
Yes, it's really specific. that. I don't know if Bernstein's all the examples that we've received.
It's not in the example.
Yes, it's not.
So, and I'm trying to go at this principle. I'm not trying to expand the fact pattern. I'm just saying that I don't know how to apply the principle if this method is not allowed.
Well, I think what
or a class of policies, and I'm not trying to argue investment components at all.
Okay.
So I think there may be more to explore here with regards to those type,
I think it's going to be really difficult to explore this on the flight without seeing examples.
Yes,
that's fair. I think we need to reach some kind of understanding if we are happy with basic principles, and if we see, or after this discussion, if that happened, that there are different fact patterns that have not been fully discussed, you might bring them as a submission, but it's really hard to pick and choose, because I think that we can't imagine now what kind of contracts you talk about, so it might be a bit dangerous to start.
Also subject a little bit to what Anne was saying about the problem is that you've got so many nuances that there's a limit to the number of examples that should come up.
But I do agree, what you're describing does sound not like any of the sort of examples we got. It does sound like a difference to class of...
But I think it likely has a similar problem to the contracts with investment components.
I would imagine it does, yes.
Okay. So we continue on the first bit.
Okay. Cool.
So, I mean, reiterate some of the introductory remarks that were made. I think paragraphs 9 and 21, I think last time we kind of agreed we would defer the discussion until we were looking at it all together. So, I think the wording was just a bit strong when we said we concurred and agreed to stuff. I really like paragraph 29. I thought that was really helpful, the comment about the wide variety of products. And then I think... when we start looking at the principles, I think it's really interesting, and I think it's very helpful. But when you say the following methods would not meet the objective, in most of them you say, well, it wouldn't meet the objective unless, which is very helpful. But I think it equally demonstrates the point that it's actually it's very difficult to be prescriptive here, because when you look at the facts and circumstances, and so I wonder how much we're just best to leave it to judgment. And then I think as well, whenever we've started looking at this and modelling some of, how some methodologies that we could use and how what the pattern of CSM amortisation is, you can do a really complex method that's difficult to do and requires looking at expected benefits over the lifetime and working out how much you've already recognised and how much you've still got to recognise, and loads of assumptions and loads of complexity, and you end up with not a very different pattern from straight line. and so I just wonder if we should be strengthening a bit more, because there had been discussion and around straight line was a reasonable simple approach to take unless there was evidence that there was a different pattern was more relevant, and I wonder if we should for the sake of simplicity and the fact that it actually doesn't make very much difference to the numbers strengthen that kind of in support of the principle. And we've been discussing at length some of the examples, and people read really different things into the examples, and I think it's very concerning. I think we certainly touched on this, I think, at the last TRG meeting. When someone reads an example, there's actually only a limited fact pattern that's put down, but people read that fact pattern with the knowledge of what is normal practice in their market, and that is very different. So I think there is a lot of read across, and it's only when you start looking in quite a lot of detail about maybe the example that Anne mentioned, there was read across to types of construction contracts, when you started looking into the detail of what's written in law about what those contracts are meant to cover, you know, there are some quite specific terms which change it. And so I just feel that the examples are quite dangerous.
So, John?
Thank you. I'd just like to add to the discussion on the examples here. I want to emphasize that, you know, these conclusions on the example are based on specific facts and circumstances in those examples. So you should be very careful that they are not extrapolated to other circumstances. Yeah, just to echo what Joe mentioned. Secondly, I also really like paragraph 29. That's very helpful. In addition, I agree with paragraph 30, subparagraph F, that the method to determine the quantity of benefits should not be described in particular. That it's appropriate to use a method that reflects the expectation of the amount of a valid claim by a policyholder when an insured event occurs. Yeah. I also echo concern raised earlier by other members as to paragraph 9 and paragraph 21. And also what Joe mentioned regarding subparagraph G of paragraph 30, in particular the wording on this would not meet the objective, and then subsequently say unless this and that happen. So I think that's slightly confusing.
Yeah. Thank you. I think the staff has done overall a good job in trying to have a more balanced view than in February, and emphasizing that we have a principle-based approach. I think that comes through in various parts of the paper. I think that is very helpful. I think what was said on the examples also from staff side that they are helpful to discuss, but they can only be generalized in a very limited way. I think that is something which especially the auditors in our round need to take then with them. And then commenting a bit more specific on paragraph 30, which I think is very, very, very important principles. So principle A, B, and C and D, I fully support that. I can read that out of the standard. On E, I already emphasized my issue I have, and you have already reflected a little bit on that, that the probability of a claim can have an impact on the service provided and might be not a relevant factor in all circumstances to weight benefits. When I combine different risk types into one contract and then try to weight, it will probably not be a good proxy, but it can also be the same risk. I think about the liability insurance, but I have different coverage levels, 1 million, 10 million, 100 million, and maybe the 100 million coverage has a longer coverage period, 5 years, and the 1 million only 1 year. If then really I depict the coverage units only by the contract duration and the maximum possible coverage, I have an extreme weighting of this 5 years contract with this 100 million maximum loss. So I would earn almost all of the CSM, which economically belongs to the 1 year, 1 million contract in year 2 to 5, where these contracts are not anymore in place. And I think with that, the initial objective of coverage units is not met. I understood the objective of the coverage units was to provide some weighting into the CSM release when I have a group of contracts with different durations or a very different level of services provided. And in the example I just described, I think that objective would not be met, because if I would earn the CSM for every single contract individually, the earnings pattern would look completely different on an aggregated basis, as I would then use the coverage units as defined with the maximum coverage. So in that case, I would really say maximum cover is not an appropriate proxy. I cannot use it. And in that direction, I would then also go to subparagraph F and G of paragraph 30, where I think I understand that there's more flexibility because there are situations where also premium or expected cash flows can be a good proxy, but you're limiting that. And I agree that not in all situations, any of these factors will not provide in all situations a good response. My wish would be a little bit to make it even more neutral and saying, okay, there are different factors which can be used to depict the coverage units and being a good proxy for the services provided. But there's not a rebuttable presumption that maximum contractual coverage is the right one. And if you would like to use something else, you need to prove that it's a good proxy. I would say, okay, you need to somehow prove that for every, or have an argument why this is a good proxy for all of these different drivers. I would not say there's a preferred driver and then a less preferred driver. I would leave them on one level. And then to the point of Joe about complexity, I think also the examples are helpful in some regard to initiate some thinking. However, they also show we are in a quite theoretic and complex discussion when I then see how I really need to construct such a pattern. Because now I will not claim about operational complexity. This is not the main focus of the TRG, I understand that. But nevertheless, the CSM pattern needs to be fed from some information from existing systems and information. And that sounds, and especially in this example 11, it gets really complex. I doubt that this is possible all the time to really have this in a fast close process established. And what I feel is a little bit getting lost, and back to Joe's point, I think the initial idea of the board from the 2014 discussion, where the decision was more, okay, I release the CSM over time and according to the number of contracts. I think the standing board decisions, which then at the very end of the project have been translated into the coverage units, still, I believe that the original idea or basic concept is passage of time as a good proxy for the services provided as being the stand-ready obligation and a stand-ready over time. And just, I think, reading the staff paper from May 2014, if you allow, Martin, paragraph 38, I think staff is saying, and then the board concurred with, a time-based approach to recognize the CSM in respect of the insurance coverage as a service has a number of benefits. It's consistent with the principle of stand and ready. It's relatively easy for preparers to apply. It's easy for users to understand. It's easy to audit. It would increase consistency. And it would make earnings management more difficult as any other subjective approach. So I think that is still all true. And so for me, the starting point for all these discussions should be always, okay, usually I would amortize CSM over time because that is a good proxy for the service, the stand-ready service. And I would even go one step further. For me, it's a kind of rebuttable presumption. I know... Now, we might get into a gray area if this is then really how the standard is written. But for me, it's a rebuttable presumption that earning the CSM over time is a good proxy for the services. And then there are certain situations where this is really not a good proxy for the services. And then these other different factors are kicking in. I feel now from the discussion we have here in February and now, and maybe even another meeting again, that we turn around and we need to have for every single case have a long debate with the auditors what is a good proxy and why this is the good proxy and not another factor is a good proxy and so on. But I think the basic principle that the CSM should be earned over time is somehow getting lost because it's also not reflected anymore in the staff discussion. Sorry for the long...
No, it's okay. Sue?
I think partly what maybe it's being reflected in some of the more recent comments is the fact that the context in which the question that was raised has put a lot of influence on the type of analysis that we've done. So if we go back to why the question got raised, if I remember correctly, it was to do with uneven patterns of coverage, et cetera, over time. So if you're in that situation, that's where it starts to fall apart in terms of things like just a simple over time. And maybe we need to sort of remind ourselves of that context so we don't lose that main sort of point that both Joe and Roman are focusing on, because I think this, a lot of this you need it because we were starting off analysing the more complicated cases, and maybe it's now making a sense that it's always going to be complicated, which I don't think was, you know, ever the intent, and maybe we could deal with it that way. And the other observation I wanted to make was just on the, you know, I know that you guys love paragraph 29, and I agree with paragraph 29, but I guess 29 sort of is most useful to you guys around the table because you are the experts in the market, which is why you are here. And most other people need more hand-holding, I think, than you do. And so I think that the examples and the paragraph 30 stuff helps those people who really are looking for educational guidance from this group of, okay, I've got something a bit more complicated, 29 gets me so far, but, you know, what are the boundaries and what sort of things can I think about? And I think that's what we're trying to get at. And I completely acknowledge that examples are always tricky. We always have the same discussion at the Interpretations Committee as well. You know, there's benefits of having examples because it helps with the specificity of illustration, but there's always a risk people assume something that's not there or their fact pattern's slightly different and they don't understand that the analysis would completely change. So, but I think overall it's beneficial to understanding.
And only one comment from my side. When I remember the 2014 discussions, and that was over time, but I think then after that, the board realized, okay, maybe that not in all situations this reflects really kind of service provided, and therefore we try to creating something better, but which is not excluding over time. Because this principle, I think, was then realized by board members, maybe it is not adequate in each kind of fact pattern. That was the reason. But we have not left it. We have try to make it also reflect this kind of services where over time is not reflecting. Mary?
Could I make one very simple point, which as the principles are being distilled in paragraph 30, and clearly there is wide consensus around the table that people favour paragraph 29 that talks about the exercise of judgment. Can I just ask whether, as those principles are being distilled, could we also capture the principle that that judgment should be determined systematically and rationally? Because that, to me, strikes me as being a very important principle. And that's in paragraph 20. And I think it goes without saying because it should be underpinning all of our financial statements and estimates.
Hopefully
that we do it. Here, where we have so many complex examples, I think it would be helpful just if that could be carried.
Thanks, Mary. Gail?
Yes, thank you. I think I'm probably in the same place as Mary, actually. So I think you're absolutely right. The staff are right to try and clarify the principle, and I agree with all the comments about the time as the starting point, and the reason we've got this is because of complexity. I was a bit confused why some people disagree with paragraph 21 in the paper, because I thought that was just came from BC279, where I thought the board were clear that the pattern of cash flows and the release of risk doesn't affect this service, but we can debate that. The bit that I focused on was paragraph 30F in the paper, because I think that is the heart of what this principle is. And I think it's a wording point, because some people have read this as saying, I can either use the contractual cover or I can use the number two, the entity expects. And that's why I think Roman's raised his example of the maximum contractual. I didn't think this was a choice, but I think some people are reading it as a choice. And I wonder if in my mind, the principle is it's the maximum amount that the entity has to pay if a policyholder has a commercially valid claim at any point in time. So that takes you coming down when you repay your loan. But it means that, so if there is, if it's just a maximum contractual, because they can always claim up to amount or there isn't, then it would be that. But that it's not a choice between the two, because I think that may be where some of the confusion is coming from. And I agreed with most of the... I think examples are dangerous, but I think you need them to try and articulate some of this stuff, because I think people are struggling with. But when I read some of the examples in the staff's analysis, again, I wasn't sure if you were saying it could be A or B. I think it's A or B depending on the facts and circumstances, and I don't think people are necessarily reading that, so I think we need to be really, really, really careful when we write it down, because I don't think it's a choice. Coming back to this systematic rational, I think it should be a principle you're trying to apply, not a choice, which might help as well.
Thanks. Francesco?
Thank you. A couple of things. The first one is the idea of reaching a principle is the right target, in my opinion. But I think that you are very close to a principle. And when we look at the paragraph, paragraph F, subparagraph F in 30, the second Roman 2, the amount of and the entity expects the policy order, to me, it is actually the universal principle that would really reflect the words in the standard. The maximum is really deceiving. I completely agree with Roman Sauer, it should be deleted, actually, because it may lead those that perhaps, to go back to Sue, that are not as knowledgeable about the multiple different types of products, to actually conclude that irrespective of whether there is a different level of expected maximum claims that a policyholder can make, which is the real benefit you can be committed to pay and stand ready for, you can still use the maximum. And when we look at the example on the workers' compensation, the 5 years, workers' compensation with a maximum, but the reality is that the employer cannot make any more claims than the salaries of the people employed at any given time, which is an expected amount of the benefits payable under the contract. Now, it is, if you think about it, in the measurement, it is a number that it is calculated. It's the same amount before the application of the probability that those claims actually turn into cash. So it is there in the computers, and it can be used. And that, to me, when I go through the 16 examples, I find that actually that could be, maybe with some refinement, a universal principle that can actually link back to the word benefits in the standard for insurance service. The second point I wanted to make is about this distinction in the paper about contracts with investment component and without investment component. Although it's true that there are these two categories, I don't believe that is the right distinction to drive an effective discussion on coverage units. I believe it is actually more useful if we debate the presence of different sources of revenue. And that is effectively going back to the two possible services. One is insurance service, the other one is non-insurance service, when it is not distinct from the contract and it is not unbundled and accounted for under FS 15, because the investment component, based on paragraph B120, will never feature as a revenue in the standard. So I feel that looking at the investment component is not right from a discussion perspective, because then it takes, in the three categories, it takes some of the things that actually are revenue for the insurance company when they sell that contract, but they are somehow not linked to an investment component. Going back to the point of William, if you have such things, then you need to ask yourself, how is it that I can create that kind of asset dependency? Is that because I deliver a service? Well, if there is a service, then I should really think about whether I'm doing the calculation correctly for the coverage unit perspective. And that's where I'm hoping that later, when we touch on the multiple services, we can take that into account. The investment component is a basis to calculate revenues arising from a particular type of service, which is very common, the investment-related service. But there are other non-insurance services that should not be forgotten, particularly when there is no investment component. There could be very significant sources of revenue. And having a principle that deals with them, in my personal opinion, would be better than not having it.
Gerard, do you want to answer to it, or is it different?
So I think probably the answer to that would be, given that we're interpreting the standard, I don't think that is within what the standard is saying. And I think we heard a very solid message, or very strong message, at a point in time that people found it very difficult to apportion an element of revenue to each of the individual services that you might offer in a contract. And hence the objective here of looking at the two core services, if you like, the insurance service, and for those insurance contracts that qualify, the investment service. But that wasn't actually why I put the thing up. I had a slightly different question, which I had thought about when Roman was talking, and then Gail sort of re-raised it, so I thought I might as well ask the question. My understanding initially about your concern around the paragraph 20 conclusion and the earlier conclusion was the way that we'd been thinking about it. For example, in life contract, the probabilities of claims change over the period. And we thought we were very clear in BC 279A that that was not what we intended. That we didn't want to see that sort of pattern. But when you started talking about your specific examples, I think your objection to paragraph 21 relates to this relative measure between different components within a contract. So your example of the million and the 100 million is actually more about, I've got two different contracts, how do I actually determine? And one proxy may be the probability of claim in that circumstance. That's what I wanted to just clarify. And I think that was, and I think Anne also gave a little bit of a clarification about that as well.
Okay, thanks, Dara. Massimo?
I fully agree on the observation of Roman for what concerns the contract without investment component. So I'm fine with the principle-based approach that is included in the paper, but let's say, looking at the paragraph 21, I would prefer more neutrality between the potential drivers that may reflect the CSM release over the time. And I think it's dangerous to have this maximum contractual over on top of the list because it seems that it should be a sort of default. And instead, I'm for this kind of contract, I guess that the rebootable assumption or a default would be the time rather than drive the release of CSM on the maximum contract cover that, especially within the group, may be driven by a particular set of contracts that may end up with a pattern that is not, in my view, consistent with the service. I also agree with Francesco on how to distinguish the different contracts for what concern the different kind of services within. I guess that we have already in IFRS 17 the wording about investment services for the investment contract with DPF, for example. So I think it would be better to distinguish between contracts that include insurance and investment services rather than investment component that I guess it can be problematic for what Francesco said.
Nora?
Thank you, Martin. I think paragraph 30 is very helpful and clear when we start from the stand-ready obligation ID. In particular, I would like Francesco, I like very much the introduction of the ID of expected level of cover, which is a very good complement to the maximum level of cover, which is fraught with certain limitations. I have a lot of sympathy for the comments of Roman and Massimo. I'm slightly uncomfortable with the way things are presented because it's giving the impression that maximum level of cover and expected level of cover should be a bit by defect options. And I think the diversity of insurance contract is such that there should be much more leeway.
Thanks, Laurent. Carla?
Just an observation from a prudential perspective. The content of this paper is of course about performance reporting. That doesn't have a direct parallel in the prudential framework, but of course it is key in with our transparency sort of financial stability objective in mind, and thinking with that sort of hat on, I was just thinking about this point of paragraph 29 and the need for examples. I can't help but think that, and without sort of passing judgment on the technical merits of each individual example, I can't help but think that there will be a need, as Sue was saying earlier, for individuals examples for different types of products if we're going to avoid a situation where the same product or type of product is being accounted for differently in a way that isn't justified by underlying economics. With that in mind as well, I was quite sympathetic to the conversation that was the exchanges earlier about the passage of time and the role that plays versus the role that, you know, that some of the other ideas play, because, again, from a transparency perspective, I can't help but think that perhaps can be made clearer.
Okay, thanks. Back to you, Anne.
Leslie.
Oh, Leslie, sorry.
Just a couple things. I wanted to rebut what Francesco and Massimo were talking about, but I think to me it belongs in the next section. So just silence was not agreement there. I'm sympathetic to Sally's point that the example said B42C is valid. That could create a... I agree with her that it will often not be valid, and we don't want to create a situation where because this says it's valid, we have to prove that the method we use is similar to it, to the point of... So saying something is valid, it can create a bar that we don't want to pass. Another is... in our read in Canada, the one that was pointed out was we thought B23C, the fact that B23C was not valid, but B31C could be valid, seemed to be a direct contradiction. It's comparing the amount expected to be claimed with the amount expected to be claimed in future periods, and then comparing the expected amount of claims with the expected amount of claims remaining to be covered in future periods. We found it hard to understand why one could be valid and one could not be valid. But I actually just point that out to say this just shows that there is some ambiguity in whether you take the expected level of claims into account. And seeing this kind of thing that sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't, just points out the need for application of judgment. I'm sympathetic to the view that, I mean, we're not talking about being capricious here. We would apply judgment in a reasonable manner, but it may be too high a bar to make sure that we're all, you know, exactly consistent because we're all so different. It's just there's too many different variations of the product of products and situations, and there's different reasonably valid proxies that won't give you exactly the same answer, but may give you reasonably consistent answers. We just don't want to be held to too strict an interpretation.
I was going to be quiet that whole one, but I couldn't.
Yeah.
I think just building on the point that was just made now, so in example 12, this is the life contingent annuity, right? So it's really simple. You get 10 currency units each month until you die. And basically, you go through three possible ways of amortizing the CSM. The one is just amortize it over the expected life, so 40 years. The other one is basically say, how many payments do we think will be over the life? So let's say there's 1,000. How many have we made in the first year? 100. So we earn 100 over 1,000. And then the other one says you need to use the probability-weighted average duration of the contract. And you reject A and B and only say C is okay. And I think coming back to the point Leslie just made, that seems a bit harsh because they're probably like all reasonable approximations. And I think that's the danger possibly of these examples is, you know, if in 2 years' time someone wants to use, you know, number B, which uses, you know, how many payments are we going to make in the future? And you know, would I as an auditor have to say, no, you can't because that was dismissed in the paper.
In general, I agree with the comments made about we need to be very careful to say that the examples are don't rely on their very specific fact patterns. We're saying these might be ways of doing it. You know, that doesn't mean you absolutely have to do it this way, but on Kevin, on the one you've raised, I mean, I suppose that's the one where I would have said that the standard does say that you look at the expected duration of the coverage. So that's the sort of the one, possibly of all the examples, that's the one where I would say there are words in the standard that say look at. Are you saying you wouldn't?
I was saying the other two are approximations and probably get there anyway.
So you would argue that they get there because they are materially close enough to the outcome you would have got, rather than because they're the correct outcome, the correct approach.
Yeah, probably. Yes.
Which I think is then a completely different discussion.
If you're saying because it meets the objective,
not the theory,
then I think we'd agree, as opposed to saying just because that's the maximum duration, then that's okay.
But also,
very different things.
Yeah, if you look at it, if you look at the number of payments, in order to work out the number of payments, you have
to be, it has to be based on the expected duration of the contract, isn't it? Because you have to, how otherwise you work out how many times you're going to pay? You have to look at your mortality curve and say, when I expect an event to occur. So this is the same thing, just expressed in a different way. And from that perspective, you know, my view is that we have to be very careful when saying, oh, this is not a basis, because the only thing that the standard says is you cannot base it on the pattern of cash flows, and that's what the standard says.
Yeah, and I think in that case, the example is dismissed because it requires an entity to split a contract into multiple individual contracts, and I guess, you know, that's a different...
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. I'm going to try and sum up on that bit before we move on to the next bit, because otherwise I'll never remember, but some of that I will. So I think what I'm hearing is that everybody thinks that it's good to have a principle-based approach and have this objective that we're trying to show how service is provided, that we need to be clear that people should look at the examples that are in the paper and treat them with care and not extrapolate. They're based on specific facts and circumstances, and that the methods we've identified might not be the only methods of getting to the way that service is provided. Looking at the principles that we've got in paragraph 30, I heard, you know, agreement that we should try and establish the principles, perhaps that we need to soften the statement on the likelihood of a claim that's at the end of 30E, because sometimes that might be a way of getting to a proxy of the service. We need to establish as a principle that this is not a choice, it is about providing service, and you need to make your estimates of how you do that on a systematic and rational, you know, judgment. I heard slightly different messages, I think, about whether we should focus on what's in paragraph F little 2 being the amount you could validly claim, or whether we should be thinking, or whether we should be focusing on that, or whether we should be saying that often a straight line allocation is going to give you a reasonable proxy for the provision of services. I think I'd quite like to get some reaction on that, because they do seem to me to be not the same thing. You know, the amount that the entity expects policyholders to be able to validly claim, in many of the examples we've got, would not give you a straight line basis. So are people saying in those sorts of fact patterns, is F2 what people think entities should be aiming at, or are you still saying actually, you know, straight line, you're still standing ready, you've got what are people's thoughts on that point? Because some people were saying straight line is good enough, and other people
you have to be careful with that, though, right? Because it, in simple fact patterns, yes. But most of the analysis is much more complicated situations.
And that's, but I just wanted to
get read up. So I don't want everybody to say, yes, great, and we all think that that's then an easy conclusion.
Because I just wanted
to
check that people weren't saying straight line in these more in these sorts of fact patterns.
Yeah. Only if it gives you a kind of
reserve. Yes.
Then yes, otherwise not.
And then I heard that you would like the methods that we've got in G, where we say this might be appropriate or this wouldn't be appropriate, unless you'd like that made sort of more neutral in terms of... So, as with the methods in F, to say these are methods that might work in particular cases.
Even G2.
And in
even G2.
What would people think about G2?
Would that be difficult to argue about the fact that...
Yes, I...
I think the summary, I would agree maybe with the additional comments that it would be good to passage of time just to mention, okay, that is the starting point, and for many contracts that will be a good proxy. And now I think we have discussed in the THG more complex pattern where the insurance service over time varies, or we have combination of services where we need to see how for a group of contracts we can depict then really the coverage the insurance service provided. I think that would be helpful because, as I think some of you mentioned, I think given this 40-page paper, for a lot of people reading that, they have the feeling, okay, I need to really, for every contract, to try to come up with some a complex pattern, and that is the requirement. I think the requirement is if I have a service which is equally provided over time, the passage of time is a very good proxy for the service provided. So if we can justify that as a starting point without saying that this is the principle which overrides any of that consideration which are in that paper, I think that here I would also feel not comfortable with. But you need to have then, I think, it must be really clear that passage of time is not a good proxy, and then you need to search for something else. And then I would list the different drivers which you... which we have discussed, maybe and mentioning their limitations, but somehow on an equal basis. So F and G, I would not say that is the basic assumption, yes, and the others no instead, but just to list them on an equal basis and referencing their limitations, which I think we have also discussed. I think that would be from my perspective.
But, Roman, just to be clear, if I could clarify, you're not talking about something like a rebuttable presumption, are you? You're just saying that's the starting point of analysis, but you still need to consider whether straight line is the good representation of the surface. You're not saying that if you can start with straight line and then not think anymore. You've got to think about whether or not it represents the surface.
Yes, I think
if I understood Roman correctly, it's partly about setting the context of this entire discussion.
Yes.
Yeah, but in that case, I think that we need to start from what Anne has written in F2, because that is a proper principle, and the education can be given to explain when straight line comes out of that principle. Unlike other colleagues in the group, I don't feel any threat from examples, as long as we have clear principles. Actually, the examples, when you have clear principles, just prove the point that the principle is clear and it works. So I don't have the same concern about having examples, as long as we get a principle that is actually informed by a clear objective that links back to the economics. And then I think that F2 is a very good candidate to become such a principle. I also want to react on two points. G2, in my personal opinion, is correct. So that is not something I would like to dilute, because it's true. That is a fact, in my opinion. And equally, the last sentence of E is also true. That's why I'm talking about expected benefits, which is before application of probabilities. The moment you start applying the probabilities, you enter into cash flow projections, and that's not anymore the benefit. It's the measurement of what you're going to pay, because you have a benefit to stand ready and give that protection to the policyholder. So those two things, given that there were a specific question about what we think, I felt I would like to qualify my view on that. Thank you.
Thanks.
Just one little... Sorry.
Yeah, quick reaction to what Anne asked. One suggestion is to move G3 and 4 to under F as possible methods, and change the wording slightly to say this is method based on premium if they can be demonstrated as a reasonable proxy, for example.
One small point in your comment on the last sentence of E in respect of Vasily's point, sometimes that is the same thing as the duration of the contract. So it can't always be wrong if it's the same thing. The other point in F2, I'm okay with that for the insurance service, but we haven't discussed the investment service yet. I want to keep that open. I don't want us closing any doors.
I thought we are done.
Right. Okay, so moving on to what everybody has been waiting for, which is to look at insurance contracts that do have investment components. And here we think that the analysis is different for contracts that fall within the scope of the variable fee approach and contracts that don't, because we think that IFRS 17 uses the scope of the variable fee approach to identify which contracts provide investment-related services, which contracts should be treated as providing investment-related services as well as insurance services. So for the variable fee approach contracts, we think that they should be treated as providing investment-related services. We think that's clear from the discussion of these contracts in the standard and the basis. We think that the wording of the definition of the coverage period in IFRS 17 doesn't make that clear, that that's what we're thinking of for variable fee approach contracts. So we think it might be helpful if we modified that definition for variable fee approach contracts to clarify that that is how the variable fee approach treats these contracts. So that is all set out in paragraphs 34 to 40. And could we talk about the variable fee approach and then move on to the general model?
Leslie?
I think when I was reading this at first, I was aghast. It's clear that the VFA are not the only types of contracts that provide investment-related services. I mean, I think the way you put the distinction of the three different types before was the way I would consider it. If it has an investment component, it does provide investment-related services. There's no question. We do provide those services. The existence of the investment component proves that. I think the distinction between the variable approach and the variable fee approach and others is that only does the variable fee approach treat investment-related services as if they are insurance services. But that doesn't mean that you don't have investment-related services in other types of contracts. And to me, the issue is some contracts with investment-related services contribute a lot of revenue through the CSM. In other words, you get revenue, but because a big portion of the CSM was created from or what did originate from those investment related services. So to have a completely different treatment of the coverage unit of the amortization of the CSM for VFA contracts versus indirect participating contracts where the benefits vary with the underlying and you've reflected that in your discount rate, to me is just those are almost the same contracts. They are not different. They're only different because the scope of the VFA is narrow. In type, they're exactly the same type of contract and the contribution to the CSM is similar. So I don't think that the CSM amortization pattern should be so vastly different. So generally, I think we should be including the investment components. You haven't asked that yet. But in any event, I don't think the right drawing point is VFA versus not. Because all contracts with investment components provide investment-related services.
Can I ask you two questions there, though? So you are you saying that you are comfortable with the outcome for VFA contracts? That's the first question.
Well, I can't distinguish them. I am uncomfortable with the inconsistency.
Okay. The second question is, do you think a contract that provides you, say, just a promise to pay you back your premiums is providing you with an investment service?
I don't know.
It seems to me an investment service is something more than the basic return I would get by putting my money in the bank.
Okay, I don't want to address specific patterns at this point in time. Okay, I've got two things here. Number one, I don't think that the standard restricts the coverage unit to insurance services only. I think it's ambiguous. I think you can read it as if it's insurance services only, but I don't think it is. I think it can include other services and other benefits.
But
I think more importantly, as a general principle, you would want to amortize the CSM roughly in proportion to the services that actually created the CSM. And in that respect, investment components can be very important. They often aren't. Often it's a small piece of the picture. It's not a big deal. And so I'd ignore it, probably in your example of the return of premium. But in my variable universal life contracts that just don't quite meet the VFA, it would create a huge cliff there for me that doesn't make any sense.
That's a broad world aware of this cliff when we developed the variable fee approach compared to the general model. I think that is not new. And you said, okay, on Daryl's question, you don't know. But when the board has drawn a line between what we think is investment service and what is not investment service. And that is in the standard, and that is the scope of the variable fee approach. And if we now say, okay, no, that distinction is something different, I don't know where we land, because that was clearly, I think, what the standard said. Okay, there is a kind of asset management service, then we have investment service, and then, okay, we have the variable fee approach, but all others are different because we cannot distinguish between what is then insurance, what is investment. That is really where we have drawn the line. Therefore, I think we, including that was a rational.
You can't say that only VFA contracts provide investment-related services. That is
what we have said in the standard. We have defined it. Maybe people have a different definition. Yes. I agree with that. But in the standard, there is a definition what is an investment and what is not.
No. So? For the purposes of 17, we very carefully defined what we think are insurance services and investment services.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is not disputing the fact that there might not be returns from investment within a contract, but for the purposes of 17, a distinction is made based on the BFA.
My other phrasing of it better then, that what the VFA is? Are the contracts where investment-related services happen to be treated the same as insurance services? I'm really coming up against that. How can you say only VFA provide investment-related services? Where does it say that?
We've drawn the scope of the VFA to include those where we think they are investment-related services. In other cases, they are maybe investment returns, but we don't regard that as service. We see that as an investment activity.
Okay, you'll have to tell me where. I do not accept that.
It's in the basis where we explain why we treat changes in the financial effects that are under the general model. Why we take those to profit loss. So that's in they're reproduced in the paper. So for the general model, in the paper, it's paragraph 41. And it reproduces the paragraphs from the basis to explain why, for these contracts, we treat financial changes as part of financing. It goes into the finance results and is not and does not adjust the CSM. And then that's contrasted with, and it's reproduced in paragraph 34 of the paper, the explanation of why we have this approach for variable fee approach contracts, where we say here we're saying that the returns on the assets and the changes in the amounts that you have to therefore pay policyholders, that's all part of your variable fee, and that's why we treat them in that way. So that reflects what the board's rationale was for the treatment of financial changes under the general model and the treatment of the variable fee in the variable fee approach.
Thanks for the clarification. Francesco.
Thank you. When I read the standard, I thought that the rationale for having the variable fee approach because of the need to revalue the unearned profit. The key difference between the general measurement model and the variable fee approach is that you take the changes in financial variables to adjust the CSM. So it is effectively the unlocking that is very different in the two models. In one, as you explained in BC228, you don't take into account financial variables, but in VFA you do.
Yes.
However, when I read the standard in terms of the other, there are two things happening with the CSM. One is the unlocking, the other one is the allocation. There is only one allocation basis for all models. And coverage units, as far as I can read the standard, they only serve one purpose, allocation of the CSM, not unlocking of the CSM. So I hear the standard sector saying, we want to make the difference. And I agree with you, as far as unlocking is concerned, absolutely, absolutely. But allocation is one. You've written only one model. So I don't see why you should qualify the very good amendments you are proposing. Well, when you look at the allocation of CSM, that amendment is right, but it's right for all contracts. There is no distinction between those that unlock with financial variables and those that unlock without financial variables.
You have to go to the rationale for the reason that we had a different unlocking adjustment was because the service was considered to be different, and the unlocking principle is you unlock for changes which relate to future service. So to the extent you think it relates to future service in one model, those things are the service you allocate over. If you think it's different services in the other model, then you use that same consistent service to allocate over, and that's why there is a distinction. It's all about what you see as the service in both cases. It's the same.
True, but that doesn't mean that the CSM that is not locked with financial variables under the general management model shouldn't be allocated.
Well, it does, because you unlock for service and you allocate over service. You can't unlock for one sort of service and allocate over a different sort of service. I mean, that's not consistent.
That's not written in the standard. The standard,
that's why
the standard only talks about one model for allocation of the CSM.
The model is the allocation according to service, and then it's a question of what the service is, and that's why we propose a tidy-up on the
But
DFA
the tidy-up
is
valid?
Yes. Or only where you think there is service.
Where you get this unlocking.
But the difference between VFA, I mean, I don't see in the standard a logical basis to see where is written what you're telling us today.
It's the service. Why would the service be...
And the concept of coverage.
Yeah.
Coverage unit.
So the coverage unit is there only for one purpose, which is to allocate the CSM.
According to service.
I'm not revaluing. The CSM in the general model is not revalued. And we're not asking you to revalue it in the same way as the VFA. Those two models remain different.
No, it's about
But the allocation
service.
Of the CSM is done based on one logic. And if you say that the logic of allocation for the VFA should be improved to explain that the coverage period includes also investment-related services, that should be not qualified, given that there is only one basis for allocation of CSM.
There's no investment-related service in the general model, so why would you allocate it over the general service?
But that's simply not true.
In IFRS 17, it is true.
No, it isn't. You are simply not remeasuring the component of profit arising from the investment-related services since you measured them the first time. That's the only thing that's different.
No. When we developed the variable fee approach, when there was a group of the CFO forum here and explained us that this kind of contracts is more like asset management service. They're really managing the assets of the policyholders, and that is a different service from insurance, and therefore we need a different model. And this service provides, okay, if you have a kind of percentage in the underlying items, okay, that is more like a variable fee in asset management, performance fee. And therefore, it is not a financial result, it is a kind of revenue fee income. That was what we explained from the businesses. That is the reason why we have, at least I have, was convinced, okay, it's a totally different service. And therefore, we have invented the variable fee approach because we were convinced it is like more a kind of revenue fee business, earning business in this investment compound, but for the others not. But they said, okay, it is like asset management. So the underlying assets belong 100% to the policyholders. What you get kind of the entity's proportion is a fee. And that, I think, we then try to have the scope of that, and that is why we developed that. And that we think is totally different from all other things. That was the reason.
I said already that I agree with that as far as the unlocking is concerned. But the fact is that even if you don't unlock as you do in the VFA when you do the general measurement model, you still have to allocate the CSM based on one set of requirements, which is B119. And given that you are saying now, when I do the allocation for the VFA approach, I take into account the investment management services, And we know that there are investment management services also in other contracts that do not meet the variable fee approach and do not unlock the CSM for those variables. I don't see why the amendment has to be qualified to limit the change only to the VFA contracts.
Would you not want the unlocking of the CSM to be consistent with the allocation of the CSM?
I'm not. But I'm saying that the standard is only giving one model for allocation, but now you are with this amendment, you are creating two models.
Well, we're trying to make the... In each model, we're trying to make the allocation and the unlocking consistent. So for the variable fee approach, we're saying that you unlock for services, including investment-related services, and therefore you should allocate looking at insurance and investment-related services. For the general model, we don't unlock for the financial effects because we say they don't affect future service. It's you know, they are just the periodic financial result. And consistent with that, we would release the CSM over a period that wasn't affected by any financial results. So, you know, we're just lining up the unlocking and the allocation. And what you're suggesting would be to have something in the general model where the allocation was not consistent with the unlocking.
And what I'm saying is that where the standard is at the moment for the allocation with one model across both types of contractor works for me, and I see the improvement that you're proposing for the VFA, one that is valid also for the other part. Because when I calculate the CSM at the start, at the initial recognition, that CSM contains the effect of financial risk. On day one, they are identical. VFA or non-VFA, that's the same. I'm revaluing the VFA, the other one I don't revalue, but still the investment management service revenue that I was expecting on day one is still there. And therefore, if I can have a coverage unit that is informed by the actual substance of the sources of profit that created the CSM in the first place, in terms of allocation, I think that the standard would be good in that way. If we are now separating two different allocation methods, one for VFA, while the other one for the general management model, given that there is a substantial number of contracts around the world that actually are very close to VFA qualification, but they don't, we are creating some really unhelpful set of financial information for investors to read. In Hong Kong, this is a major disaster. There is going to be a significant concern across the Hong Kong market because there is a significant proportion of contracts that just for the absence of a definition in the contract or in laws or regulations of a specified underlying item, they are failing, only for that reason. Everything else is the same. It's a percentage. The assets are managed in internal funds. They're only not disclosed to the policyholder. But everything else is identical. And now in Hong Kong, insurers are facing the possibility of two very different profit release patterns because of two different allocation methods.
Well, it's not just, I mean, it's the whole approach, isn't it? And so it's not just the allocation. It's the fact that under a difference arises because you treat the variable fee approach contracts differently.
Woman?
Yeah. Thank you, Martin. So your first question was VFA. I think the conclusion on the VFA that investment services need to be reflected in the CSM and the coverage period and the coverage unit, I agree. That's fine. Based on the discussion, if there's a cliff effect, yes or no, between VFA and non-VFA, I think I accept that there is a cliff effect because we have a different measurement model in general. Does this mean that now we need everything on that cliff or even increasing the cliff if there are other valid interpretations? I don't think so. I also think I agree, Francesco, that there should be one overall allocation approach for CSM. So I think what was in the paper and we discussed for non-PAR, I think these are the starting principles also for PAR. That's what I understood from the staff paper. That we do not create a completely new set of allocation mechanism for the VFA now. I think the argument you're bringing, which is made now, why non-PAR is investment services should not be reflected, is that the services, and I think that's a the first step, a good point, that we unlock the CSM for changes in the future service level. I think that's a kind of general principle. And the VFA, we unlocking for the complete asset movements. Now, in the non-VFA, do we unlock not at all for changes of investment services? I would say we do. Going to the standard B98, the so-called indirect PAR, yeah. I think we have another dividing line between within the general measurement model between contracts which provide some investment service, however, do not meet for formal reasons the direct PAR model. However, they have an investment service which is also triggering some unlocking whenever we have the participation of the policyholder, so the changed discretionary participation, we unlock the CSM for that. So I think we already concluded that initial recognition. Anyway, we have the same CSM. But then even in subsequent measurement, I think we unlock here for indirect PAR for changes in this discretionary participation rate, which is, I think, the reason is because we are changing the level of investment services. And I think that is, for me, the entry point where we can, I think, read out of the standard that investment services are reflected also for indirect PAR in the CSM. I agree there needs to be somehow a dividing line because from a pure economic perspective, even a motor policy, you can say the insurer is working somehow with the prepaid premium and is generating some investment income which is reflected in the pricing and whatever. So there needs to be a boundary. I think it's the distinction between what we can define as indirect PAR. Opposite to the general measurement model. But I think B98, I think defining a line where you can unlock the CSM for discretionary changes of the participation rate. And I think B98 also makes clear that I read it, a change in the discretionary cash flows is regarded as relating to future service.
Yeah,
but there is. So I think that is, I think, the direct link to service. I think it's stated here that it's related to service, and we are talking about participation from investment returns.
But B98 is trying to make that distinction between service and financial results, and the because the financial result is not it's related to future service. So it's in fact saying that you're not providing investment-related services. And the discretionary...
Why do we then unlock for that?
Well, if you look at B99, sorry for jumping in, B99 draws the distinction between changes in assumptions that relate to financial risk. These do not adjust the CSM. It's the change to the effect of the discretionary commitment. This is something different. It does not unlock for financial changes. This
no, not financial different. Changes.
Yeah. So this but is that's the point. Point. It's an investment service that is being unlocked for.
Yeah.
I agree.
No, it's discretion. It's exercise of discretion, which is not a service because where are we using
it? I would not see that as a service. It's more of exercising a discretion. I think it takes us to another.
Let's say I'm fine with the proposed amendments looking at the VFA. It's something that I guess it's quite important considering also our, in general, the European share of our fee approach within the participating contract. But let's say I agree with Francesco and Roman that the scope of the amendment should include also other participating contracts providing these kind of services. I think that is quite... misleading, reading the examples, you have two identical contracts provided the same services, but let's say you have a problem of scope, VFA and general model on the other end, and you end up with a different release of profit if the profit measured at inception is the same. So
If they were identical contracts, they'd they'd be in the VFA, or they'd both not be in the VFA.
This It depends. It depends on the criteria. So if one of the quantitative criteria, for example, if you issue, you may issue similar contract at different point in time, and you may end up with a different treatment.
So you meet the criteria or you don't?
Yeah.
You meet the criteria. Let's say you have to measure at inception with your contract if you meet the criteria. It may happen that a quantitative criteria that is required by VFA is fulfilled in a certain at a certain time. It is not fulfilled in subsequent years. So we have to... but the services that we are provided to the policyholder are the same. So I personally, I would not mix the type of services that I'm providing to the policyholder with the criteria that I have to meet for having the election of a contract under variable fee approach.
Massimo, that sounds like, I mean, to an extent, what you're talking about then, let's for the moment put aside two identical contracts and say they're two very similar contracts. I think that is the cliff effect that we've talked about.
Yeah.
But that cliff effect, even if you were to do something here, that cliff effect would still have an effect on the actual measurement of the CSM, which would then determine the allocation of the CSM. So what that seems to be doing is introducing a third method or third type of contract.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got a third model that sits somewhere between the two other models. One where the CSM is determined just by the premium type of income and is spread over the coverage period. One where it's determined by investment returns as well, the variability of investment returns, and is spread over the investment return space. And one that lives somewhere in between the two. So I think the problem is, or the thing here is that you've got this distinction already. And as Martin said, One answer to this may have been to say, identify every cash flow that relates to investments and every cash flow that relates to insurance and split your contracts from the beginning. We've heard all the way down the line that's not a feasible answer. So the idea was then two models with a clear dividing line. This is the implication of that dividing line.
But for measurement, let's say, and the consequence that being under a variable fee approach, you have the measurement, I agree, in the sense that there are some key criteria to be fulfilled in order to be in the VFA, and based on that, you have a different unlocking and a measurement of the CSM. What I'm struggling, also looking at the example, is to have, in the example, the same products, providing, for sure, the same services, and a conclusion saying, if it is under VFA, this is the way to allocate the CSM. If it's in the general model, the driver is different. Why, if the kind of services is the same, we're talking about the same.
Well, and that might be where I was
the same
ask
example.
You, I was going to ask you a different question because you started out by saying you agreed with Francesco and you agreed with Roman, but I actually heard Francesco and Roman saying slightly different things. I think Roman was looking at a much more constrained model, whereas I think Francesco is looking at a much broader. So not.
I think Roman's was just an example of Francesco's to support Francesco's.
The example of the endowment, the example number 15. Let's say, in my view, you are describing a contract that for sure had an insurance coverage, but an investment service component that is quite evident and significant, and you conclude in a different way in realizing the same contractual service margin at the beginning, if the contract is under the VFA approach or not. This is something that, to me, is not consistent, and I do not read this in IFRS 17, to be honest.
Can we do the following? First, I think we should say, okay, do we agree it's not an amendment, it is a clarification that, okay, the investment components should be considered coverage units in the variable fee approach. Secondly, do you agree that the standard is currently saying that, okay, if you have contracts which are not under the variable fee approach, investment components has not to be?
No.
Third topic is then, do you want to change the standard that for this kind of general model where you have an investment, you think is an investment service, that it should be also reflected in the coverage unit?
Would that
structure the discussion? Because I think it's otherwise all over the place. Can we agree on that?
No, I think actually I can reconcile these two. I'm going to take a stab at this, okay? I think what the staff's view is predicated on is that the coverage units, or the coverage units, should represent only insurance services.
In the general model?
No. Let me finish. As it's written, that the amortization of, or the definition of coverage unit, should reflect only insurance services. And then you are recognizing that only in the VFA are the investment-related services actually treated as insurance services. And therefore, for the VFA, you include the investment-related services as insurance services in amortizing the coverage units, and that's all. Okay? I can understand and appreciate the logic of that position. However, the other position is that the services over which you should amortize the CSM are not necessarily limited to insurance services. It should include all of the services that generated the CSM.
But what is in the standard? Isn't it said insurance?
No. The standard, except coverage in is, that it one, it doesn't, it
but
says...
But if investment coverage is concerned... Well,
okay, if we get, it's B-119. When I read B-119, it is ambiguous. To reflect the services provided under the group of insurance, this amount is by identifying the coverage units. The number of coverage units is the quantity of coverage provided, determined by considering for each contract the quantity of benefits provided. It says benefits. It doesn't
but
say
it
insurance
coverage.
Benefits.
It says coverage.
And it's a coverage defined term is, in the standard.
Coverage period is defined.
Okay, I'm going to go look. Hold on.
But okay, that at least we have one opinion and say, okay, the standard is not clear. Things coverage also.
I think the standard is not clear.
Okay, that was my second question. Was okay. Yes, others, man. Do you first okay variable fees, second okay if your general model is it clear, and third okay is there a wish to
reading the words first?
So I can understand the logic of the VFA. I am concerned that I'm not sure it's a clarification given this long discussion. I am concerned with making a change to the standard and what the ramifications of that. But can I just pause again on these? The reason I am struggling, I didn't read investment components linked to investment service, number one, so I hadn't made that linkage that the staff had. When I look at what I call the failed VFA contracts, so these are the ones where the amount I pay out to my customer clearly has a linkage to some return on assets, but for whatever reason, I've failed to get into the VFA model. I think those are the contracts that I'm struggling with. And initially, I thought I wasn't going to struggle with them because I thought the investment return, so I'm going to expect to earn 10%, I'm going to pay my customer, I don't know, 2% off, so 8%. And I thought that that 2% that I earn as a spread each year would come along each year as I earned it. And then I thought I was okay with it. Unfortunately, when you look at example 6 in the illustrative examples, that is not the way the model works because, of course, you're projecting out at the whatever, the 8% and discounted back at whatever percent, but you create a CSM element to do with a non-insurance service, something to do with financing. And whilst the coverage period of the insurance and the other thing is the same, it doesn't matter. But the problem we've now got is the reason we're even discussing this is because we have contracts where the insurance service component is completely different from the financing component. So now we have earned some of that CSM for this spread, which appears to be very similar, which is why I think people are saying it's like similar investment service. But I could earn it over 2 years rather than 30 years. And I stand back and I say, does that make sense? Now, I don't want to change the standard because I think politically opening this standard is not a sensible thing to do. But I am struggling. By changing VFA, I think you have that question on the table, and that's my nervousness.
Is there a contractual right from the policyholder to get this 2% in that year? No. That is not my understanding.
There will be a contractual right to earn a return.
A return, right.
It could be zero.
Yeah.
But I think that's why I have it.
Gail, setting aside the fact that you caution us on the wisdom of opening the standard and question the legitimacy of outcomes, when you read the words at the moment, do you agree with the staff's view that the allocation is linked to the provision of insurance services because of this link to this coverage period concept as worded at the moment?
Yes, and the other thing we challenged ourselves is, could we get to the outcome you're trying as a board to get to without changing the standard for the VFA? And we didn't think we could, unfortunately. We did try that, but we couldn't.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, that's helpful.
Need another auditor's view.
I was going to say, reading the words first and reading the words that define coverage unit, we see uncertainty.
Why?
Because you have two sentences, and the first sentence, I think, actually makes it clear, and the second sentence makes it less clear. So, bear with me one moment while I'm turning pages quickly. So, coverage period, I think if the definition stopped at the period during which the entity provides coverage for insured events, I think would be crystal clear. I think what makes it less clear is that you have a second sentence that says this period includes the coverage that relates to all premiums within the boundary of the insurance contract. And some of those premiums will go to create investment spreads that get capitalised into the CSM.
Okay, thank you.
Next was Sally.
Hey. Those discussions. I'm just thinking that reading through the standard, I also didn't get a conclusion that for investment components which is not fitting to the VFA, there's no investment services. And when reading the paragraph 39 with the definition of CSM, it says that a CSM and the unearned profit entity will recognize as it provided service in the future. So to me, unless you say that for those policies, from the very beginning, CSM shouldn't include any services, investment services, for the profit in the future. Otherwise, it must be have something you should consider under the amortization. I don't know whether I make that clear or not. Unless start thinking that for those type of contracts, there shouldn't be any investment services profit, including in the CSM. But reality is, because we do have lots of profit policies that do not meet the definition of VFA, but for those CSM, majority or big portion are from the investment services or type of investment services. So how come you cannot amortize that according to investment service, only to the insurance services? It just not make sense, especially when the duration or type are not the same. It just make your account results, it's not make any sense. So I think look back to the definition of CSM, I think you should consider somehow. Is that can get away that you say, for those type of policies, investment services are kind of or part of the insurance services you're providing. Because we are providing insurance policies, we provide a kind of insurance services and a kind of investment-related services, you can definitely it as also a part of insurance services. For policies in China, especially the life side, lots of policies which do not meet the definition of VFA, but we do provide a majority of them are investment-related, sort of. So I'm just thinking, to find a way out, we don't want to change the standard, I agree with that. And that can conclude with that, because I read through, I didn't get a conclusion there's no investment services can be provided, or investment services-related profit can be included in the CSM.
JP?
Yeah, thanks, Martin. No, I all share the concerns raised by the PR members.
charges regarding the indirect power contract that can be and cannot be determined exactly whether it falls into the category of the pure breach or general model. In between, because especially for the universal type of contract, that's the typical example of the indirect power contract. For those indirect power contracts, I think there must be some kind of considerations for investment component or investment-related services. But the confusion came from, looks like, from my point of view, that, you are confused with the definition between investment component and insurance-related services. In practice, when we say investment component, which is referred to as kind of surrender value, when for pure production type of contract, when, but there are some kind of, surrender values in the middle of the coverage period. But there is no investment amount returned to the policy at the end of the contract. Those kind of features is considered as a investment component, according to what I know, what I understand. But to clarify, to solve the issues, I think ISP need to clarify on the definition of investment component first. And I think it's time to come up with some kind of middle ground solutions between insurers and ISP, I think, for those indirect power contracts. I think, how about using the materiality criteria in determining whether insurers are allowed to consider investment component in recognizing CS release pattern. But, when the cash flows in a contract, cash flows relating to the investment component are material, then, why don't you allow insurers to recognize those investment-related services as a pattern of CSM release instead of just using accounting model? That's what I would like to suggest.
Yeah, that was the third question which I raised. And can we concentrate on these three different
things? Thank you. I have, respond to your questions, Martin. I have no objection to the amendment proposal as written in paragraph 38 of the paper, but for reason that explained by you and also explained in the paper, I think it's very important that the proposed amendment must be limited to VFA contracts only. I acknowledge it's not ideal that contracts that are similar or virtually similar end up with different, the accounting end up very differently. But it's the standard that require accounting depending on whether the contract is in the scope of the VFA. So it's on this basis that whether a substantial investment-related service is provided here. So you have, VFA, then you have that, the investment services. So I think it's appropriate to maintain this principle. So for contract under VFA, the CSM is released on both insurance and investment. And for GMM, it's important that this CSM is released based on insurance only.
Okay, next one is Herman.
Yeah. So my reading of the standard is that coverage can be more than only insurance coverage. When I think because we need to see it in the context, and the context, I think, for the VFA, I think it gets very clear that investment services is a very important component of the services because we established a separate, or you established a separate measurement model for that. But then I think I've pointed to a paragraph also in the standard where we have the unlocking for spread changes. So in a typical universal life contract, if the level of benefit coming from the investment part is changing and I change my spread, that is reflecting an unlocking of the CSM. I think that is also demonstrating that service is a broader term for such indirect power contracts where I have a specific unlocking mechanism for discretionary changes. And in these cases, I think even without changing the standard, we can come to a conclusion that investment-related services should be reflected in coverage period and coverage units. Now, if this is the overall majority would say that is not possible, then I would also opt to adopt the standard in a way that this is the ultimate outcome, because any other outcome, I think, will lead to very, very strange pattern. I think some of you mentioned already. Just an additional example, sometimes insurance coverage period and investment service period really differs. We have contracts where we have a long accumulation period and only insurance coverage kicks in very late contract. Given a narrow interpretation that we can only earn the CSM over the insurance coverage period, that would mean for such contracts 10, 15 years we would earn zero CSM in the P&L, whereas I think the main profit source are the investment-related services from a pure economic perspective, and that, I think, is an outcome which is just not...
You earn a financial result. I don't understand that. You earn a financial result.
No, but I think initially in the CSM, the main part of the financial result is in the CSM. Yeah. Yeah. Because initially I project the spread, and that's in the CSM. Yeah. So I think... I understand that the standard is trying to distinguish insurance service result and investment result, but I think we need to accept that for such products, it's really integrated, and as a matter of fact, the initial spread is in the CSM, the same as for VFA contracts. So anyway, for such contracts, the differentiation between insurance service result and investment result is diluted. So we should not use this as an argument why we cannot now reflect that in the CSM pattern, because that will not help to keep the insurance service result clean of any investment-related result. So that is my...
Laurent?
So keeping it short, I of course agree that investment services have to be considered in the calibration of coverage unit for BFA business. As was said earlier, I disagree that it should be prohibited for business eligible to the general model. There is a bright line in the standard in terms of accounting models, but there is, in practice, from a business perspective, no bright line between contracts, and this has to be reflected in order to have a meaningful financial statement. To the point of Massimo that similar contracts over time would be treated differently, I have a lot of sympathy. Think about a guaranteed contract, which is profitable at inception, eligible to the VFA. Then the contracts get acquired, interest rates are moved, and the guarantee is in the money. The contract would be a BBA contract, and just for that reason, the coverage unit would have to be changed, and the service rendered to the clients are the same over time. And this is something I struggle with.
I just wanted to echo what Roman said, because if you look at the economics of these contracts, the fact that the initial CSM includes a massive proportion which is related to the insurance, not just to the insurance services, but to the investment component of the services that are provided, it economically doesn't make sense to allocate only based on insurance coverage. And also, in addition to that, in paragraph B98, clearly states that that change into the discretionary element of the cash flow, which is related to investment return and the activities that the insurer has performed managing the assets, is actually a future-related service. It is one more argument that the standard, actually, the way that it is written at the moment, actually allows you to do that, because if you read B199, it doesn't refer to a coverage period. It just says in each period.
Okay, man, we still have over time. Maybe William?
Yeah.
Then Francesco, but then we will sum up.
Thanks. Now, I think back to the principles for determining the coverage units for amortization for the general model and without investment components that we talked about earlier. And, you know, you don't want to be thinking about the perspective of the insurance company and the cost that they think about. You know, you want to think about it from the services that the policyholder expects to receive. And for these types of contracts that don't meet the VFA, I think the policyholders have a clear expectation that the insurer is providing them with investment management services for a lot of these contracts, not just... And the bar to get into IFRS 17 in terms of the amount of insurance service that's being provided is actually fairly low. amount of significant insurance risk that you need to have in a contract is fairly low. So there's actually a fair amount of room to have other services within the contract being provided. And I just think back to the customer's point of view, and I think in a lot of these types of contracts, there's a clear expectation on their part that there's investment services. And I don't think where that their expectation begins and ends lines up well with the standard here. And unfortunately, I'm not as convinced as these guys are about the ability of the general model to unlock for the changes in spreads on some of those contracts. So I'm worried that we're going to be taking a fair amount of this investment margin that's embedded in the CSM and effectively amortizing it over the insurance risk, which is kind of the issue you were trying to deal with in the VFA when you have significant investment services in the first place. You didn't want all of those investment margins to be amortized only over the insurance period or the insurance service provided, because that may not be representative of the overall services being provided. So it's kind of the flip side of the same issue.
Yeah, maybe I understand that, but I think it is difficult then when you have to draw a line, what is an investment? And Gerrit's question 1 hour ago is, okay, man, if you have a simple deposit, is it also in your definition an investment service? Or what has it become? What has to come in addition? Because my understanding of investment service is a little bit different. It is not only to place money and then, okay, it's the discretion of the entity to do something and by discretion to give something back. That is for me not asset management, not investment service. That is depositing. And depositing, usually you get a financial result and not a fee income. That is, I think, a fundamental difference which we currently have. But I wanted to close with Francesco.
Now, I think that the premium refund is a good example, because it would actually allow me to propose a solution to...
That's good.
I'll try at least. And the solution would be, I already said that I support the amendment, but without qualification. So what can I replace it with? And my proposal would be, why don't we consider the definition that you have in the standard? It's not in the Appendix A, but it is referred in the standard that there are contracts where the cash flows are dependent on the asset returns. So what I call them asset-dependent cash flows. In that example, for example, the premium refund is not an asset-dependent cash flow. It's fixed and guaranteed. It doesn't change with the value of the asset, so I would not take that into account. But in all the other contracts that Roman and William did talk about, they are asset-dependent cash flows. And when you measure the CSM on day one, 90% of the CSM often is from investment management services. It's just that you don't revalue it afterwards because they're not VFA. But 90%, even greater than that, is investment management services. And it's really difficult for me to accept that we are so close to a good solution and that we're just escaping from it. But if we do asset-dependent cash flows, maybe there is a solution that we can accept.
I would suggest even more general than that it be based on the services that contributed to the CSM. Yeah. But, I mean, that's as a general principle, it's hard to...
Okay, I think we should stop here, and because we can discuss it for the next 2 hours, I would ask Anne to them.
Well, I'm not going to go back to the things that we summed up, the principles for where you don't have an investment component. But so there was an agreement that for the variable fee approach, we should be looking at the period where investment services are investment-related services are provided. I had slightly different views about whether that could be read into the words of IFRS 17 confidently as they are, or whether a clarification would be helpful. For general model, I heard almost entirely, with one exception, strong views that we ought to be looking at investment-related services for some contracts under the general model. Again, differing views as to whether that could be read into what we've got already or whether we would need to change the standard, and differing views on exactly what that change would be if we needed to do it. And yeah, that is my...
No?
maybe to add, isn't it? But I really think, man, what is the, I said, okay, we have different understanding what is investment service and financial service, and we should earn a fee or a financial result. I think that's just. But having said that, I think we all need a break, and we come back at 4 o'clock.